feel like I need somebody to just be in charge of my taping.
Like never hit
I thought you meant it didn't work.
You didn't hit the record.
I just didn't hit the record.
Oh, shoot.
Yeah, I hit the start. Yeah, but I put my notes on there. So that's what's on the thing. So what I want to start with, this is lesson 13 for 24 and 25, but I want to just do a small review of last week, what we talked about. last week, what we really talked about is the parable of the wedding feast and how Jesus and God has already included everyone, no matter who they are, on the invitation list, inviting them in. All are included. It was really talking about the inclusive kingdom, because no matter what we say with our mouths, we still act as if the kingdom is exclusion first and then inclusion. In other words, you're not in until you do something, until you say something, until you believe something. Scripture does not present the kingdom that way. It actually presents it differently. And sometimes we say we believe that, but we don't act like that. So the whole emphasis and thrust of last week's parables was, no, everyone's included. It's at the end when I see people who say, I don't want to be included. Like my cousins who were invited to our costume party, and they said, we don't want to be silly. We don't want to be in costumes. We don't want to pretend. So we'll come. Well, what good is that? I mean, you're not allowing anyone else joy, and you're sitting there basically with arms crossed saying, yeah, try to make me happy. Try to make me enjoy this. And God says, well, I'm not going to force you. I'm not going to make you enjoy this. I'll let you go outside where there isn't a party going on. That's really that forceful piece of Jesus talking to the Pharisees. And when he talks to the Pharisees and he gives them these woes, it's with this utter mournful, oh, I wish you would want to stay here. I wish you would want to stay in the kingdom, and you don't. And it makes me sad and angry because you're losing on life and you're choosing that. I've given it to you already. I mean, have you ever given someone a gift, like a fantastic gift, and they put it in a drawer? And you're like, This gift is great. You will love this gift. I think that happens sometimes. Weddings, you used to. It doesn't happen anymore because we have registries, right? Mm-hmm. Registries already say, this is what I want. You better give me this. I'm opposed to registries in theory because it is this is what I want. This is what I expect. And this is what you need to live up to. I mean, that is what a registry is, right?
I've never been down the road, but I know what I'm going to need.
That's right, exactly. When the giver, I mean, it would be, see, we don't live in a society anymore that gives gifts. We only give transactions. So it's very difficult for now. People go, oh, but it's just more convenient for me. Yeah, because now it's just a transaction. Oh, I have to give her that. Because mm-hmm. down the road, I'm going to need that.
When you better buy a gift, that's as much as the dinner.
Yes, right, because there is that little formula. Okay, so where are they having? Oh, they're having it. Ooh, that expensive place. Oh, so I better give them a little bit more. So all that to say, Jesus says, I've given you this fantastic gift, and you're saying, yeah, I don't want it. So some of us have gotten, in the olden days, gifts that we never would have asked for. And I can remember one. It was a pewter bowl. I still have it. It's a pewter bowl, and it had like Nordic. I've showed this to. I told. Actually, I said when I die, Linda can have it because it's either Norwegian or Swedish. I think it's Swedish.
So why do you need it now?
I know. Why are you waiting?
I probably should, right? When I remember getting it, going, what is this? Like, this is so weird, and I had no idea what pewter was at the time. So I'm just thinking. I just thought it was ugly. You know, come to find out it was pewter, it was very expensive. And it dawned on me years later, oh, see, my last name was Parkinson. So they're thinking, oh, I come from a Swedish home. There was a lot of thought put into it.
Wow.
Yeah. And to me, I'm like, what? I mean, as far as my Swedish heritage, I don't know. Because since I don't know my father, I have no idea what kind of heritage it was. So anyway, all that to say, someone has put a lot of thought and has given you their best. And you're like, yeah, big deal. No thanks. You know. So the inclusion before exclusion, the exclusion is your choice. The inclusion has been God's choice. So flip that from what we usually do. So that's really last week's lesson for us to understand. So this week we come to kind of this odd chapter in Matthew, because it seems like it's almost out of context. But we have Jesus walking out of the temple now for the very last time. He doesn't enter the temple again, and he actually leaves it. But he's already pretty much said, look, the temple's done. I'm the temple. This is where heaven and earth meet. Remember, that's what the temple was, that sacred place where heaven and earth meet, where God's presence is actually full. And he says, I'm that. But he walks out of the temple for the last time. And where does he go from the temple? Yep, to the Mount of Olives. So he goes from the temple to the Mount of Olives. What that should evoke, particularly for them, and it should evoke for you if you know enough of prophecy, is, first of all, in the Old Testament, when the Spirit of God left the temple, remember the Spirit of God has not been in the temple for years, when it left the temple, where'd it go? The Eastern Gate, out of the Eastern Gate, up to the Mount of Olives. So we have Jesus reenacting that, kind of saying, look, I'm leaving the temple, I'm going to the Mount of Olives. And then, of course, we have in, boy, where is that? Zechariah, I think, that has the prophecy. When the Messiah returns, where will he return to? The Mount of Olives. Not the temple, the Mount of Olives. So we have this picture. Remember, everything Jesus does, he's reliving the history, and there's all these pictures that it evokes for those who are living it at the time. It evokes these very strongly, because unlike us, unlike the body of Christ who doesn't know Christ's history or Christ's people's history, they knew their history well. They didn't have books. They had to memorize it, and they did memorize it, and they knew whole books, and they knew all of Isaiah and Ezekiel and Zechariah. So they knew this. So these acted out pictures are very fresh to them, and they see him do this. And basically, as he does this, he's saying, look, the old system is over with, but now since he's going to the Mount of Olives, he's saying, but the new one is in. The new one is beginning here. He's trying to show this is now the transition from the old to the new. Mm-hmm. There is something coming else. It's not just over and done with and we're done, like the Sadducees would believe, but there's something new coming and I'm going to inaugurate it. From here on in, everything I do is inaugurating the coming again, the coming of God back to the holy place. So from here on in, from the Mount of Olives in, it's the inauguration of that to come. And so we have then the disciples asking him questions, of course, about this. For them, when he says they want him to look at the temple, at how magnificent it is. And by the way, it is a magnificent thing. It would be considered one of the wonders of the world, particularly then. Mm-hmm. That would have been like an amazing thing. Like there's no one that could ever destroy this because it's, I mean, there's nothing to describe it like it. The pyramids in Egypt, perhaps, but this is bigger and definitely much more interesting, I guess. But for him to say, look, the old system is done. This is all not going to be what the system is like. For him to say that, and for him to say the temple, basically, we know this in the other Gospels, the temple's coming down. For them, the temple coming down is the end of the world. That does mean the end of the world, because they know that everything is pivotal about what happens in the temple in Jerusalem for the world. For the world as they knew it then, the end of the world and the coming down of the temple comes together.
Well, their whole life was linked to God's presence.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what
I mean? Who were, in fact, what does Moses say in the desert? If you leave us, who are we? We're not a people anymore if you leave us. So for the disciples, this is their thought too. If the temple's coming down, the place where God meets man, where heaven meets earth, this is a big deal. Like this is the end of the world as we know it, as it works now. But we do know you're saying there's something coming, there's new life coming. When is all this going to happen? When is the temple going to be destroyed is what they're really asking. When is that going to happen? And he does affirm, yes, there is going to be an end. There is going to be an end to the world as they know it, as we even know it, this separation of God's reign from earth. And there will be signs, and I'm going to put that in quote, there will be signs, but the signs are there. He wants them to know the signs are there for comforts and reminders that, yes, they need to happen. Transactional life has to wear itself out. It has to die in order for new life to come. So that the signs are there for comfort, and that's important for you to know, they're there for comfort and encouragement that these are things that are supposed to be happening. They have to happen for new life to come, but not they are not there for them to obsess over or for them to revolve their life around investigating. And this is very apparent in the fact that the signs he gives, and even the signs that we find in other parts of Scripture, are very ambiguous. They are not, I defy anyone to study this, to study Daniel, to study Revelation, and say this is the definitive picture. Mm-hmm. As soon as you've done that, you've done exactly what Matthew's been talking all about, is this is your picture. So be careful. So really what he gives them very ambiguous signs, signs that actually were and have been fulfilled over and over again. What he wants them to understand is, look, your life isn't about signs. Your life isn't about, oh, the end's coming now. Your life is about living the new kingdom life now. And to be encouraged that it needs to continue to happen. You need to continue to live that kind of a life.
You know what's interesting with the whole birth pain thing is that, I mean, you're just so used to thinking about the end of the world is like the most horrible thing.
Yep.
You know what I mean? And when he likens it to childbirth, you're like, oh, yeah, it's horrible, yeah. But you're still, I don't know, your attitude is still like there's life coming.
Yes,
in it.
Exactly.
You know what I mean?
Like, and that's his whole point is, don't think of this as horror. I mean, except for the reason I never even wanted to get married, let alone pregnant, was because my mother only told me about the horrors of having children. That's all she told me. To her, having children was a horrible thing, and so being pregnant and going through the pain was awful. But that's not the norm.
Which is funny, because like the worst of it, right?
Yeah.
Is called transition.
Right. Exactly.
You know what
exactly.
I mean?
Yes.
It's just
yeah.
Like exactly what the kingdom.
Yes.
Is,
exactly. So that's.
Susan, how do you feel about that? I heard a horror story recently.
Oh, no. But see. Jesus does not focus on the horror of it.
Right.
He focuses on this. These are necessary things. And we're going to go through really kind of what that looks like. So I give that caution because I know for some people they get. So I've seen both ends. Some people get here and go, oh, prophecy. Oh, I'm so excited. I want to dig in and I want to know what were the little things that look like army things and were they flies and all of this crazy stuff. And I have probably for the last 15 years refused to teach the last part of Daniel and Revelation, mainly because of that, because we focus so much, kind of what we've been doing with the tragedy now, right? What have we been doing?
Yeah.
We focus on every little piece of horror rather than what God's doing in it. We focus on, I didn't know like you, Kim, I didn't know about it until the next night and Bill told me. I didn't hear anything until last night. I went through, I was tired of something, so I thought, I'm just going to sit and veg. And I went, and of course the news is on. If I heard another time, let's look at this piece of plastic. Let's look at this piece of pressure cooker. Look at the name on here. And I'm just thinking, really? Is this what our whole life is about, is focusing? I mean, it's like we have this odd, visceral experience that we can see the piece of plastic that was blown up, and we can see this. Jesus is doing this. This is not the place we focus on. This is not who we are. We are not people of tragedy. We are people of victory. Where do we see that? How do we see that? let's look at how that happens. And these things actually have to happen in order for the transactional world to die, to just wither itself away, give all its energy, let it go, so that the new life can come. So the first thing he says to them is, they want to know a sign. What's the sign? And so he gives these little kind of signs like, well, here's one sign. Don't be misled by them, but there will be false Christs. But don't be misled. That's his emphasis. Don't be misled by them. There will be false Christs. False Christs will be people who say, here's how the kingdom can come in, by being against something. In other words, they will use the world's way of doing things in order to bring in the kingdom of God. They will say, you've got to be against this. You've got to fight this because the kingdom needs to come in, so you've got to fight this. And remember what Jesus is saying is, I work in a totally different way. I don't work the way the world works. I don't fight. I actually absorb. I absorb so that it dies rather than fight, because fight always continues, right? Fight always brings up more fighting. But that's what a false Christ will do. He wants the kingdom to bring in. And when we say false Christ, it's not specifically people who say, I'm the Christ. It's people who say, I am part of the Christ. I am someone who wants the Christ's kingdom to come in. Mostly religious people. Mostly people who say, you know, we want good. We want God's kingdom to come in. And therefore, we need to do this. We need to be up in arms about this. We need to be against this. And really, I'll just use the word against for false Christs. We saw Jesus being for whoever was the least, whoever was, like Sherilyn said, even the terrorists, he was for the Roman armies. He was for all of this. The against did not really play into it for him. Basically, they will preach ways to be blessed. They will preach ways to be holy. They will preach formulas, ways to do this, and exclude or minimize grace. When you hear anyone's emphasis not being grace, it's a false Christ. It is against who Christ was, because that is the kingdom. The kingdom is grace. The kingdom is healing and restoration, not putting them in boxes, not giving them formulas to way to get holy and be holy, because holiness only comes by grace.
And it's funny because you have the Antichrist at the end, right? And he's like, you know, he's kind of doing the stuff,
right?
Right. He's kind of doing it right.
Right.
And then he'll do like something different.
Right.
Right. This one thing different. Now think about the whole pig sacrifice thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, essentially, he's still saying there needs to be a sacrifice. He's still saying there needs to be a way.
Yes.
We can't make the way.
Yep.
But then he makes the way something other than the Lamb of God.
Correct. Right.
Which we can do.
Other than grace.
Right.
Exactly.
You know?
And that's exactly what Jesus means here by false Christ. And so we'll talk about that if no one knows what she's talking about with the pig in just a second. And I'm gonna say this right now before we even get into this. All of these little signs and everything for the tribulation, please take them as even for the little tribulations in your life. All of these. So this is not one event, and you're gonna see that in a minute, that we're all looking at. In fact, most people believe that Jesus isn't even talking for the most part about just the tribulation, but all the tribulations, particularly for the disciples. The disciples are having a hard time wrapping their head around just the fact that he's going to be crucified and resurrected. It would be very hard pressed for Jesus to say, okay, you don't get that, but now let me talk about like the end of everything, way beyond, and all of these things. He's really, like, he's very aware of what they know and understand and can comprehend. He's talking about something that's going to happen in their lifetime, as we see. And it will actually happen in their lifetime. Therefore, we look at this and go, what's happening in our lifetime? So I guess what I'm saying is, please don't take all of this in Matthew 24 as there's one big event that's going to happen. Don't take it as the Left Behind series. And we're going to talk about that. Because it is so, like, and I know Jerry Jenkins, so that's kind of like, it's kind of scary. Anyway, Don't be misled. And then he says, don't be frightened. Here's some more signs. Wars, famines, earthquakes, which are really ambiguous, right? Because from the very beginning of time, there has been wars and famines and earthquakes, right? Mm-hmm. The earth, since the flood, has had earthquakes because of the flood. From ever. Always. All the time. And so, you know, I mean, I've been in circles like this. I grew up in a circle like this of, there's an earthquake. Oh, earthquake. Oh, two earthquakes this week in the world? Two earthquakes? It must be the end time.
Mm-hmm. And usually they say, this is very scary.
Yes. Mm. Yes. And the whole point, the reason Jesus even brings this up is, look, these are things that are going to happen. Do not be afraid. Do not be afraid. These things are supposed to happen. This is part of getting rid of the transactional world. This is part of it. Be calm. Be calm. Independence will always be fighting. The independence in people will always be fighting one another to separate. The world is literally shaken. It has been shaken since the flood. There was at one time one unified world that was shaken from the flood, and that's why we get earthquakes. I mean, just meteorologically, that's why we get them. They are birth pangs, though. And as Sherilyn pointed out, yes, there is going to be great pain ahead. There is pain in your life now. There are tribulations in your life now, and they are purposeful. It's supposed to be there. Just like someone who has a child within them. You are supposed to have some, at the very beginning, kind of uncomfortable, depending on if you had a lot of morning sickness or not. As it gets farther and farther along, right? It gets harder and harder, more pain, right? So Susan's probably like in the middle, but she knows what's coming, right? She knows. In several months, it's going to be like, get this baby out of here, right? You always come to that point as, I'm ready for the big tribulation. I'm ready for the complete shaking of my body, right? I'm ready for that because this cannot stay here. So, yes, these are just birth pangs. Yes, these all need to happen. These are supposed to happen. I know what I'm doing. That's really what he's saying. I know what I'm doing here. These are all good things. So he says, so what are you supposed to do in the midst of these, in the midst of little tribulations and big tribulations, whether it's the tribulation or all the tribulations that are coming before that, endure. What does he mean by that, endure? First of all, the word is hupomeno. It's a word that we've used often over and over again. It means to remain under, but in this case, it means to remain under the breaking of the world, stay there. Like if someone said to Susan, you're uncomfortable right now, oh, well, then just get rid of it, right? Just have someone induce you right now and get rid of it. And what, Susan, what would you say?
That's ridiculous.
That's ridiculous. Absolutely not. Why would I do that? Why would I sacrifice the life that's coming because I'm uncomfortable, right? Mm-hmm. This is what he's saying. Endure the breakage of the world, and in enduring the breakage of the world, endure it under the rule of grace, under the rule of restoration and healing. Your point of being a disciple is to live in the midst of the breaking of the world as one who is healing and restoring and under the rule of grace rather than fighting it. I mean, Susan, how would you fight being uncomfortable right now? Yeah, there's not a whole lot you can do, right? I mean, this is how it is, right? And because any of us who have children, is there anybody who has one child? I think all of us who have children have more than one child, right? You do it again. You do it again, right? And you pretend that you, oh yeah, I remember how painful that was. Do you really?
No.
You don't.
You just won't be as bad the second.
You don't. Yeah.
Well, you think about figuring things out too, though. It's kind of like, you know, they say what's the worst thing you can do in the middle of that pain is tense up.
Tense up. Mm-hmm. Exactly.
That's the worst thing.
Right.
It makes the pain worse.
Right. Exactly.
To manage it.
Yes.
And the only thing that makes it better
let it come through. Yep.
And let your muscles
yep.
relax in the midst of great pain.
Yep.
You know what I mean?
Yep.
So
exactly.
So the parallel is so interesting.
Yep. Exactly. Yeah, that is. That is exactly.
So it's so counterintuitive.
Yes.
Yeah.
Right. Because, and the only reason it's counterintuitive is because of how we live. Because we live transactionally, we think we can do, if we do something, then it will be better. And we live that way with everything, right? If we do something about it, it will be better. And I've had a couple experiences this week, some with Christians, some with non-Christians, who are absolutely convinced if they fight what's going on that they don't like, if they manage it, if they do something about it, it will work out well and everything will be okay. They just got to fit. And I've told kind of both sides, you know, just grace, let it go, let it go. Both sides. Arguments about, no, if I let it go, then things will, then it'll be a mess and it won't work out to fit my picture. I mean, I'm just watching this. Really, grace is the only, I mean, I literally emailed. Grace is really the only thing that's going to work. I'm telling you from experience. And it's almost like they're, yeah, I believe that. But in this instance, if I do this, then things will work out. If I, you know.
But I feel like that's why Jesus had to talk about it in birth.
Yes.
Like, I think he knew we would reject that.
Right.
Do you
right.
know what I mean? So he's like, okay, look at the natural world.
Yes.
This is how it works.
This is how it works, yes. It always has worked that way. It's interesting that he says that, and then he tells what's going to happen with people, because this is where we're going to fight for it. So he first says that all the nations will hate you, the nations will kill you, the nations will bring you up and make you prisoners. There will be hostility from the outside world. But understand this: hostility, no matter where it comes from, is always an hostility against grace. Because that is not our natural, that is not what we think makes the world continue on. So it will always be that. So the hostility from the outside will happen. But then what he says is there will actually be tribulation and hostility from the inside. And he's saying from the church, from those who say, I want the kingdom to come, there will be hostility there. The church itself, the body of Christ, will be winnowed down as there is a confrontation with grace. So as long as you're okay with transaction in the church, no problem. But once you say, no, it's all grace, there's going to be a conflict here in the church. There's going to be a conflict. No, it's grace and. It's grace, but I still, right? I hear that a lot. Oh, yes, it's grace. But I still have to try to follow the law. It's grace. But the law is still important. There's always this but. That's where the conflict comes, and that's where he says the church is actually going to be winnowed down, where it can't tolerate just grace.
We're already there.
Yes. Yes. And actually, we've always been there. Mm-hmm. It's working that way. But, of course, what happens is, and anthropologists have even follow the church's line, as about every 500 years, it swells up really big. And we're at one of those 500-year marks, where it's swelling up really big, where there's a conflict between grace and transaction.
So the first 500 years, it was almost like that with Constantine, right?
Right.
I mean, that's when
yep.
he was like, oh, control
yep.
and power, that'll mm-hmm. make it work.
Yep,
so,
yep,
mm-hmm.
yep.
Interesting.
Yeah. That's what we have, the Reformation coming at a 500-year point. We have all of this coming, and that's just how it seems to happen in human cycle. But paradoxically, of course, as the church, the real body of Christ shrinks, it then grows, right? Because what happens is the real church that is all about grace, that is all about accepting their emptiness and accepting the acceptance that they have in their emptiness, so that he can fill it, it then begins to grow just like a little mustard seed that grows into a big tree where birds can come, right? That's the church. That's the picture of the church, where the birds can come. And I think that was one of the prettiest pictures that we've had in Scripture, is the church is a place where birds can come, and the birds are the ones who are the birds of prey, the ones who are eating, the ones who are the least. who are taking the fruit. That's where we are. Not the pictures that we've had before. So we have this leaving and betrayal and hatred of the tribulation from the inside. So there will be tribulation from outside, tribulation from inside, and there will be increased lawlessness and cold love both places. So in other words, particularly about the cold love, it's this, anybody ever come to you with this, you know, great smile, and it's just like as cold can be, like, you know, there's absolutely no love behind that smile. Mm-hmm. And they're just treating you.
I told you so.
Yeah, you know, it's just kind of like, oh, honey. Okay, so the Southerners have a phrase. What is it?
Bless their heart.
Bless. That's right.
Just before they say something.
Yes, and you ask, and it is, oh, bless her heart. And it's what it is, what an idiot. Bless her heart. That's the cold love. That's the... oh, I am a sweet Christian. Bless her heart. She is just so sweet. What a stupid fool is what is underneath that. This will increase. This fake, this pretend, oh, I love you. I'm not going to give you any grace, but I love you. Oh, you should do this, honey. Honey, you should really follow this. And I don't mean to pick on Southerners. They just happen to have a really nice, they do. They have this nice little thing, and I've been told this by Southerners. So this is not like I don't think this. I've been told this.
Oh, it reminds me of the characters in the Help movie.
Mm-hmm. Well, yes, right, exactly. Now, do Midwesterners have this? Absolutely, just in different ways. I just think they just have a really nice, concise way of doing it.
Oh.
So they'll have this cold love. So what that means for us to endure the breakage by being ruled by grace, that means that we will have to be loving in an unloving world. And remember, that includes both the outside world and the inside world, both the world and the church. We will have to be loving in an unloving world. We'll have to be sharing grace in a graceless society. We'll be having to use, we'll be needing to fill others, live for the benefit of others in a world that says survival of the fittest. That's what it means to endure. It means to live the kingdom in the midst of the breaking of this worldly kingdom. We live God's kingdom. We live that the beauty of grace, the beauty of seeing the least in people and loving them in their leastness, filling them in their leastness. Why is it that tribulation comes? Why is it necessary? Because this is what preaches the gospel to the world. The testimony of grace cannot be seen without tribulation. Think about this. When do you give somebody grace? When they mess up. When they're doing well, can you give them grace?
They don't need it.
I mean, there is. I mean, grace says, I accept you in your ugliness. Mm-hmm. If there is no ugliness, then grace doesn't get to be seen. Mm-hmm. And then the kingdom doesn't get to be seen. Do you see that? Mm-hmm. So the tribulation is a necessity. The tribulation, whether it be the big tribulation or the little tribulation, whether it be the building up of all the tribulations, it's necessary for the world to be able to see, for individuals to be able to see, and for you to be able to see and experience grace. Grace can only be seen in the midst of messing up, in the midst of ugliness, in the midst of... So, take the bombings, right? We have this horrible thing going on. We have this... That people actually decided they wanted to kill someone. So last night when I saw this program about seeing the plastic over and over again, the first thing they did is interviewed some people on the street. What should we do to the people when we catch them? The first person said, crucify them. That's the words they use, crucify them. The second person said, hang them upside down and let everybody in the United States beat on them until they're dead. And it went on. But here's the thing. This is what we were. This is what they were trying to elicit, right?
But
by doing this.
Why are we
this is exactly what's going on. Let's beat up that fury. Let's come on. The way to attack bad things is to be bad, right? I mean, it doesn't make any sense, and yet that's the way we live, of course. What would show the kingdom of God? See, that's what I'm saying. We make sure that we rile up the emotion.
Yeah.
Yes, we don't see it anywhere. But that's where the kingdom is going to show, right? The kingdom is going to show, okay, so these people are hurting. Whoever have done it are hurting and are least and are unable to see life. Somebody didn't do their picture, and so they're upset. All right, so who's thinking about them? Well, Jesus is. The kingdom is, because that's who he went to. Now, let's just go and ask your Christian friends, what should be our response to this? What should be our response to the bombing that happened?
And Jill, I mean, I wrote a blog post about what I'm talking about.
Uh-huh.
And I will say I had 160 views of my blog post. And I had about 6 people who said, yes, that's good.
Uh-huh.
Do you know what I mean?
Uh-huh.
So, most people are like, mm-mm.
No, because there has to, because for us, justice means,
right.
No. We, there's got to be a transaction here. They did this bad, so they've got to get bad.
Yeah.
But then where does it end? See, the whole point of Jesus says, I'll absorb that so that it ends.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
This is the only way it stops.
Okay, so verse 13. But the one who stands firm to the end will be saved. Now, mm-hmm. Again, in my old paradigm, I mean, that was totally about what? I mean, that was standing firm in doctrine.
Yes.
That was standing
yes.
firm in belief.
Right.
And picture.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I
mm-hmm.
mean? And like you look and it's like, back in verse 12.
Yeah.
The love
yep.
of Moses
yes.
broke hold, but the one who stands firm
yes.
in love.
In love, exactly.
Do you
That's
know what
his
I
whole
mean?
Point.
Like the only thing you're supposed to stand,
yes.
you know, when they say stand firm, you think you have to fight people.
Yes.
And it's literally
yes.
standing firm in love.
Correct. Yep. That is what Jesus is trying to get at here. And so he addresses this because he knows what our natural emphasis is going to be. And it is sad that mostly we think that, yeah, we need to get those. We watched Zero Dark Thirty. So that is about catching, and I always forget which one, is Osama. I was thinking of Saddam Hussein because I'm watching it. I'm going, no, he's not there. He's in a pit. Where's the pit? I kept going, Bill, where's the pit? And Bill's like, wrong bad guy. Oh, okay. So that's right. So, but watching that, I actually, because of Matthew, I've actually been thinking, so what about this guy? What in him made him feel like he had to force people into what was right? What in him? I mean, this is also a human being that Jesus actually gave the gift of life to. This too. We don't go there, and we do look for retribution when God says, remember, you're not supposed to pull out the wheat. I will do that. You're not supposed to take out the fish. I'll do that.
There was an interesting discussion, though, I thought, after he was assassinated. I felt like there were voices that said, how are we better?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yep.
Like, how
yep.
are we better
I agree.
For
I agree.
Going in and brutalizing his family
mm-hmm.
and him?
Mm-hmm.
How are we different?
Yeah.
You know, I did hear
some yep,
of that.
Yep, there were
was
some
encouraging.
Of that. Yep, exactly. So Jesus, again, trying to shift our focus when he knows what's going to come happening. He knows that eventually, and here's the thing, remember again, he's in his human mind, he's allowed his divine mind to be set aside. He doesn't know that 70 AD the Romans are going to come in and crash the temple. But he does know as a man, just like we do, Israel, you are riling up Rome. You are set to have Rome come in here and take you over. He knows that, and he knows what it means. If Rome comes in and takes over, the first thing they'll take over is the temple. So he understands that. He understands that that's coming really soon. He's seen, he knows what's happening in the country. He knows that that's going to happen. So he's preparing them for that. He knows that Rome is going to come and take over, and that the temple will be destroyed just by his humanly understanding.
But he can't set his divine mind aside. He only did that after he died, where there was separation.
Maybe we'll do that in a different Bible study. Remember, we talked about that in the healings and stuff. It wasn't his divinity that did those healings. It was his humanity. It was because he was completely connected to the Father. Because that's normally what happens in the kingdom. Healing happens in the kingdom. It's not because he was divine. So those miracles weren't signs of his divinity. That's just kind of a preview of kind of, yeah. All right. So the last thing he says is, so when this is going to happen, he wants you to look to your life. What's important? He tells them, when you see the abomination of desolation in the holy place, run for your life, flee. What he's saying by that is, look and see what's important. Are the things that you have in your life important? The house that you have, the success that you have, whatever that is. What is important, real, lasting? Is it your picture of what is life? Because see, at that point, when somebody comes in to desolate what is to you the center of life, when someone comes in to do that, then there is this very clarity of what's real life. My picture of having a nice home that's safe and everything, is that my life? Because this is where it comes down to it. Oh, you know what? That isn't my life, actually. That really isn't what life is. Life is the Holy of Holies in you. That's what he's saying, is it's the Holy of Holies in you. And he's giving them just hints of what's going to come in just a few days, actually. It's the place of grace in you, that emptiness that gets filled by the Spirit's presence in you. That's life. What is life? Christ is your life, not the things of this life. Not even the temple for them is their life. And that's what he's trying to say. Don't worry about this temple being destroyed, because that's not your life. Make sure that you look to your life at what's important. So let's talk about the abomination of desolation. So this was obviously a prophecy. It was prophesied in Daniel. And actually in 158 BC, it happened. And this is what Sherilyn was talking about. Antiochus Epiphanes came into the temple and put a pig on the altar. For Jews, that would be a desolation, abomination, trying. So what does what does this really mean? We always put it in caps. It doesn't necessarily have to be a person. What it means is that something or someone is trying to make the place where heaven and earth come together empty, worthless, without value, without need. This is what Antiochus Epiphanes did for in 158 BC. He said, you know what, the temple's worthless. There's no reason for you to have to do it God's way. It's empty. It's valueless. That's what he did there. With prophecies, you always have a close fulfillment and then a farther fulfillment. The interesting thing also, though, is sometimes prophecies are just a manifestation of this is how life is going to be. So a lot of prophets say, come back, because life is always going to be about either transaction or grace. Come back, come back, come back. So prophecy doesn't always have to have one fulfillment or even two fulfillments, which is what I've always been taught, is there's two fulfillments, one close, one far. Mm-hmm. Prophecy really can be just the fact of life. This is how life is going to be. For Jesus talking to the disciples, there's going to be another abomination of desolation that comes into the temple, and that will be Rome. So in 158, we had one person come into the temple. In 70 AD, we know that Rome comes in to the temple and destroys it and says it's worthless. There's no need for it. There's no value at all in heaven and earth coming together. In fact, they say heaven and earth has already come together in Caesar. But can it possibly then come to our temple? So if maybe this is just a fact of life, that there will always be an abomination of desolation possibility. Is there something coming into your temple that is trying to make grace, the place where heaven and earth meet, obsolete, not worthwhile? Is there a place where you say, well, yeah, there's got to be, yeah, we got to have a transaction here. I've got to manage it here. It's not about grace. Is that a possibility as well? And I throw this out only as a possibility because, and I think this is what Jesus is doing. I do believe that Jesus is saying, it's not about one time. It's not about one day. It's not about one thing happening. It's about the fact of life that there's going to be a war against the grace, against the place where God says, I meet you where you're at. There's going to be a war against that. And it's going to happen a lot because we've already seen it happen once, twice, and then if you go down through history, you'll see it happening over and over again, of course, in different ways. The goal, again, is that this person or thing or event tries to displace the holy place in you or displace the holy place in Israel. Not to say that there won't be one event, but that Jesus is trying to get us to see, you need to be aware of that all the time. Does that make sense?
Okay, here's a thought, and I know I'm stuck here. Stuck with the bird. So the words great tribulation only happens once.
Right.
And it happens in Revelation.
Right.
So whenever Jesus is talking about tribulation, he never actually uses the word great tribulation, which leads me to believe that he's wanting us to embrace this idea that you're saying about tribulation as a larger concept, not just the great. So the breathing in and out cycle, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, like, if you think of tribulation as the exhale, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you always have this exhale and the exhale.
Yep.
And then if you think about, like you know, the greater the stress,
right,
the more the exhale, right?
Right.
And you're, like,
right,
like really needing to breathe it out.
Mm-hmm.
And then when you think of a birth, you're like...
Right.
You know, you're really exhaling. And, the great tribulation is almost like the great exhale of all the things that are not.
That's exactly
God.
What it is.
Do you know what I mean?
Yep, that's exactly
but
what it is.
But if you look at that cycle, the exhale is always in the same place.
Yeah.
Right? So, like, Jesus is looking at all the exhales and the great exhale.
Mm-hmm.
And they're all, like, in line.
Correct.
Even though they're in a cycle.
Right.
Does that make sense?
Yep.
I don't know.
Yep, that's exactly how he's putting it here. Look, we can just look at it all as the same, that we've got to get rid of the transactional world that we have here. And it's going to take that effort. And I do love that he begins with the birth pangs so that we can pull that all the way through. I think that really brings it kind of to a picture for us. He also says that there will be great wonders done by false Christs and prophets. So now the false Christs have been joined by false prophets. Well, of course, they have their own disciples that say, yeah, this is the way you become holy. This is the way you become good. Here's some formulas for you. Understanding that they may give miracles. There may be miracles that happen with these people, events, whatever. But miracles are not indicators of Christ. So we've always kind of, and this is why it's really important to know that he didn't do his miracles as a deity. Because if we do, every time anybody says that, their point is, oh, he did miracles to prove that he was God. Oh, really? So then what happens to all the other miracles then? I mean, that doesn't even make sense for even in God's world. All the other miracles that happen, because we do see miracles happen. We do see things happen in Scripture, let alone in the world. Miracles do happen. They're not indicators of Christ. They're not even indicators of Christ's followers, because some miracles were done with beside Christ's followers. Even in Scripture, we have that. What is the indicator of Christ and or Christ's follower?
Forgiveness, restoration.
Let's put in one word, love, right? He says, they'll know that you are my disciples by love. That is the one thing, and that encompasses the healing and the restoration. It's not by miracles. It's not by great orations. It's not by charismatic leaders. None of that, because we have lots of that. None of that is an indication that here's where Christ is. No matter how great the works, how charismatic the teachings, no matter how much healing comes out of a certain place, it only boils down to whether Christ is healing and restoring and giving grace. If that is embodied, that's where the body of Christ is. Why do we look to our life? Because Christ is our life. And he will be revealed for all to see, and it says, like the lightning. So this odd phrase that we have, I laugh sometimes at how we try to make it into something innocent. Basically just, okay, we all just saw lightning, right? Where was it? I don't know, right? It's not where it is, it's that everybody can see it. When it happens, we can all see it. I'm sure that everybody who was in Aurora saw that, right? Everybody that was in Woodridge saw it. Everybody that was up in Skokie saw it, right? Everybody saw this lightning that happened here. That's all it's saying there is. The revelation of Christ will be seen, not just when he comes, but when he's coming in us. When we're giving grace, everybody gets to see that. All the hostilities of transactional living die, as Jesus absorbs the transactional living, as we absorb it, it dies and then allows grace to be seen. It allows grace to be revealed. It allows Jesus to be revealed. We see him present then in all of the passions, in all of the tribulations. Jesus is there. Just like at the end of this, when we see Jesus actually in the least, Jesus is in all those tribulations. Like, yeah, let's get these birth pangs going. Yes, let's get this transaction dying. I want to absorb it. I want my body to absorb these things so that the new life can be seen, so that those transactions can die and the new life can be seen. That in you, Christ is revealed. When I worked at the church, the verse that I was given to work there was 1 Peter 1:13 that says, gird your minds for action, keep sober in spirit, fix your hope completely on the grace to be brought to you when Christ is revealed in you. Mm-hmm. So that Christ is revealed in you when he brings you grace, and the grace is seen, and you display it, and it overflows in you. That's when Christ is revealed and seen. This same word that will happen when we come, when we look in the next couple verses. So the need for tribulations, and I call them Exodus tribulations, because here's what's happening. Where else in the life of Israel have we seen so many 1-1-1-1-1 tribulations? In Egypt, right? In the plagues, right? We saw all these tribulations over and over and over again. Jesus again is reminding us, reliving, look, the Exodus tribulations, they were all needed, right? Pharaoh could have let them all go at one point, but he wasn't dying enough, right? It didn't hurt him enough to let go of his transactional living. And so it had to come over and over and over again until it killed his son, right? And then he finally said, let him go. All of those were necessary. A lot of times we think, we go through tribulation and we think, okay, I've had this tribulation, now I should have rest, right? Now I've done. And sometimes Jesus says, no, actually, some of your transactional stuff isn't done yet. We need more. There needs to be more. So it's this picture of the Exodus tribulations. It's the picture of the Exodus plagues, as we call them. I would love to see the equivalent of the Hebrew and the Greek at this point, because I think it's probably very close. So the Jews, the Exodus for them is always, even today, is their pivotal point of where they stand. They know that all of that led to their being released. Their being new life came out of those tribulations, that they were necessary, so that the tribulations become necessary so that they can be expelled, just like a child is expelled from a mother's womb. So the tribulation is good news. Whatever tribulations in your life, they're good news. And they're good news because it brings opportunity to give and receive and experience grace. It's the only place you're going to have it. It's the only place that grace is going to be seen. So without your tribulations in your life, you don't get to experience grace. It also means, the tribulations also mean that Jesus hasn't forgotten the world. The tribulations mean, I want the world to be able to see the grace. I want tribulations to happen so that they can see grace. He wants that all those needs, when tribulation comes, gives everyone a fair chance to be able to receive the grace, which is how we become such a big part of how the gospel is presented. He wants them to experience gospel before it's too late. Whether it's the final tribulation or all of our tribulations coming up to, it's the command is still the same. You endure in love as you live through the brokenness of the world. It's not you try to fix the brokenness. It's you give love to it to say, let's absorb that and give a new life. So we have the fact that a tribulation is coming, the end is coming. We have him now talk about when the sun is coming. And this is my favorite part. I just love this. So in verse, 29, that it says, but immediately after the tribulation, the sun will be darkened and the moon will not give its light and the stars will fall. Okay, so all of you who've ever followed the last maybe 50 years of eschatological wanderings, you know, we all go, did you see the moon tonight? It's red. It's darkening. I mean, I've heard this when I was growing up. This was such a big deal. I don't know if it's still so much because I'm kind of taking myself out of that. But I want you to think, I want you to get rid of all the ideas you have about tribulation and the word that's never found in the Bible, rapture, and all of that other stuff. I want you to get rid of all that. And I want you to think about this. If Jesus is always reliving things, what's being relived here? When in the world was everything dark and there was no sun or moon or stars?
Before creation.
Before creation, there was a void. There was nothing. What's he doing here? He's saying, look, tribulation is coming so we can kill what has been here, what has not been meant to be, so we can begin again. Let's get back to the void, to the place of darkness, so that new creation can begin. And so we have the lights of earth darken and the heaven and powers shake, just like before creation. Just as with prophecy, it can happen over and over again. The first time this happens, he's telling us about it. He's prophesying that it's going to happen. The first time this happens, when? When do we know? Yes, at the crucifixion. The sun darkens and the earth shakes. Right? Just right then and there, this is a signal. Ha! Earth, as we know it, is done. The world as we know it is done. And a new life is coming. And then it says, the sign of the Son of Man appears. And that word there, appears, is shines conspicuously. Then there was light. Remember when we look back at Genesis, when it says then there was light, it was not talking about the sun or the moon or the stars. It was not talking about a natural light. It was talking about a light that was the Word that had spoken it into being.
That brings life.
That brings life. Exactly. And of course, we look back into Revelation and we see there is no sun and moon, only the light of God in the middle of there. And so we have this, in this small little passage, we have this, the tribulation is happening because we're shaking earth. Hebrews, we talked about this. The earth and heavens will be shaken, get rid of what was not meant to be, and there will be this new dawning of a new life that comes, and the sign will be a light. The sign will be something shining and bright that you cannot ignore. It will be a very conspicuous light.
And we call people the light of our life.
Yep, exactly. So, The light is the sure indication that earth as we know it, that the world as we know it, is forever over. So, it says, then all the tribes of the earth will mourn. Now, I'm going to give you an option of what you want to look at this, because it can be one of two things. It can be the fact that now all the people are mourning. Oh, we missed it. We completely missed the opportunity we had for the new life. That could be the one. So a mournful regret. The other side could be that they are mourning for Jesus because it's just the light of Jesus coming before him. So you know how light enters the light. Let's say you're bringing a flashlight in. You see the light before you see the flashlight, right? So that's, they're mourning for Jesus. Oh, and it's this one last appeal that God perhaps brings in to receive the life, the grace that he has. It's like this split second. Oh, the light's coming. Oh, that is where life is. This is a new life. You know, it just depends on where you stand on how God deals with people, which it is. I don't know. And I vacillate back and forth between the two. Since that's not the emphasis of the passage, I'm not really worried about that. I don't really feel, because it's ambiguous, I also feel like God doesn't really necessarily need us to be right on there. But what I do see then is that the Son of Man then comes. He comes on clouds. Please remember also, he's using metaphorical language. So don't place it as, oh, he's got to come on a cloud. Well, that's kind of a goofy idea to think that Jesus must come on a cloud. Since that is this earth, we don't know what the new earth looks like. We don't know what clouds actually mean. There probably won't need to be clouds because Eden didn't have clouds because Eden was watered from the ground up. So, again, metaphorical language. Jesus comes on clouds and he comes in glory. And I'm thinking, if we've had the Exodus tribulations and we have God leading them out, Moses leading them out of the tribulation into a new life. How does he lead them into a new life in Exodus?
With a pillar of cloud.
And a pillar of fire, right? And the word glory there means it means basically fire, a radiance that you can't ignore. So we have, again, this metaphorical language of Jesus leading them out of the old world into the new as a pillar of cloud and a pillar of fire. And then he says he has his messengers or angels gather the elect. That word elect there is the same word we saw, and it's the only time it's used again, in Matthew when at the wedding feast last week. Remember it said, many are called, few are chosen. Remember we looked at that? That word chosen means to choose myself, to choose oneself. So it's here. He gathers all of those who are still wearing wedding clothes, who have received the gift of the invitation, who've said, yes, I love these clothes, I'm keeping them on, I'm celebrating. He gathers all of those. And then what he does, and the next couple parables will have it, it says, what he will do with those who were faithful, with those who received, he will put them in charge. He will make them rule. Well, what does that sound like?
The Garden of Eden.
That's right. He puts them back into what we were meant to be, rulers of the earth, of his possessions in the earth. So he puts them back ruling again. We have it just after this, and we have it again in 25, several times. Put back in charge, put back in charge. This is one of...
Does that mean that the wedding clothes are actually no clothes?
Yes. Yes, absolutely. Right? I have nothing. He has everything. Yep. That's exactly it. That's exactly it.
There's no shame, nothing to...
Right. That's right. Hide. Yeah. It's his presence that's clothing me, not my whatever I've done to put on. Christ's coming always means life to those who receive it, whether it be his first coming, whether it be his comings over and over again through and in us, or his very last coming. It will always mean life. So we have there an end is coming. Christ is coming, but there's also judgment coming. This is after the tribulation, after the sun appears, is when judgment comes. And this is where I revel in this, just to kind of turn everything on its head again. So when is this judgment coming? During a time of normalcy, during a time of we're just doing what we normally do. Yep, there's tribulations, and we're marrying and eating and drinking and everything. We're just doing normal. Yep, tribulations are here, but you know, these are kind of normal. This is when it comes, because it says it will be a surprise to all, including the sun. And that right there, why does that not stop us from speculating?
Yeah.
When it says even the sun doesn't know?
Yeah.
Oh, but you know what? If we just plot it out, you know, we got it.
Yeah.
If we I mean it's really about the most arrogant thing you can do.
Yeah.
When it says right here, and he, the Son, is saying, even I do not know when it's coming. And then it says, some will be left and some will be taken. Now, I want to go through all the takens that we've talked about in Matthew, and then you tell me what it means here. So throw away everything you know, everything you've been told, everything you've been read. So, he says, taken away, like in the flood. Who was taken away in the flood?
Noah.
He was taken away?
Oh, no.
The people.
Yeah.
All the other people were taken away, right? The people who weren't prepared, who were not concerned about what God was doing, they were taken away, right? We have the parable of the, I didn't mean chaff here, I meant
the tares.
The tares, yes. The tares and the wheat. At the very end, Jesus says, what am I going to do with the tares? I'm going to pull them out. I'm going to take them away, right? So he takes the tares away. And what are the tares? They were sown by the evil one. Okay. The fish. Remember the fish? And he says that the angels take all the fish out, and then they start taking some out. Which ones did they take out? Do you remember?
The bad ones.
Yeah, the bad ones, the trashy ones, the ones that didn't thrive in life. They didn't choose, right? The wedding guests that we talked about, or the wedding that we talked about last week, who was thrown out of the wedding? The man who wasn't dressed. And we will have more in the next chapter. We will have the slave who was the slave who didn't do anything with his talent. He was thrown out, taken away. The one who didn't feed the hungry, he said, they told him he would go away. Now, you have this whole body, just in Matthew here, of all these things that were taken away. Who gets taken away?
Those that don't know
Correct.
God.
Those that are not prepared. Those that don't receive the grace and the wedding things. Those are who get taken away. The ones who are left are who? The faithful ones, right? The ones who receive the grace. Those are who are left. So when you hear someone say, I don't want to be left behind, they have their theology all messed up. It's completely the opposite. On top of which, pretty much everything in there is opposite. The taken ones are the ones that are taken out of. Because remember, he's bringing heaven to earth to make this new place. He's not taking people out and go somewhere else.
Never caught that before. Mm-hmm.
This is why it's so important. Context. You know, we look at this, and surrounding this is all this. I mean, Matthew has said over and over again, people are taken out. These are taken out. The things that don't receive the grace are taken out. And then we read this verse, and like, you just wonder, what were they reading? And here's the sad thing. I have spent time with Jerry Jenkins. I have all my left behind books signed by Jerry Jenkins. And now I, you know, and a nice guy. But I do want to.
I'm sure God used it.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
What about that movie in the late 70s?
Oh, yes. Yes.
Oh.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yes. Well, of course it's very frightening. That's the whole point, right? Is to frighten.
Yeah.
What's Jesus' whole point? Don't be afraid. Don't be afraid. Just be ready. Live in grace. That's all. Just live in grace. The servants left to inherit are the faithful ones. So we have this coming up next here. They're observant. That word faithful there means observant and steadfast to whatever the master has promised, that they trust him. In other words, they believe that the master's rule is good. A faithful servant believes that the master's rule is good. A bond servant. We've talked about that many times. They're sensible. That word means to use practical wisdom in relationship with others. So their whole point is that they're relating with others and using God's wisdom as how to deal with one another. In other words, grace. And they give the household food. They take care of the needs of others. That's what a faithful servant is. That's a servant. That's someone who actually has trusted in the grace that they've been given, and they are the ones that are left to inherit. The servants that are taken out, they're taken out to the place of the hypocrites, or the gnashing of teeth. They are, first of all, indifferent to the master's rule. Oh, master's not here? I don't care about the master's rule. I'll make some decisions now since he's not around. They rule themselves. They make their own kingdoms and their own pictures. They beat their fellow slaves. So they oppress others. And anytime you see oppression, always think transaction. They oppress others with transactions. Instead of using practical wisdom to relate to others, they oppress others. They make sure to separate them from us. Then they eat and drink with drunkards. This is not the same as when Jesus says he ate and drank with sinners. What this is implying here in the connotation of the words is that he indulges himself. It's all about him basically getting drunk and filling himself with things that aren't of life. And anytime I indulge myself, I try to make myself feel better, it's always a choice for separation, which is what we talked about last week. So we have here the two different servants, the ones that are left to inherit and the ones that are taken away, that they don't want to live in grace. They want to rule themselves, and God is not going to allow them to disturb the joy of the party, and he's going to give them the choice they wanted. They wanted to rule themselves? Okay. So they'll be taken out. There will be a separation of the sheep from the goats. But here's the problem. They've all been under the care of the shepherd. They've all been there. They've all been included to begin with. They chose to be excluded. They refused to leave their independence. When it talks about sheep and goat, so I looked up the difference between behavior. A goat is very independent and very curious. They will go off on their own, and that's how they prefer it, to be off on their own, them trying to make decisions about what to do. Sheep hate not being in the flock. They hate not being together with other sheep. That bothers them. It frightens them. They will always flock together. So when we say goats and sheep, it really talks about the independence of the goats, of the ones who are, I'm going to go off my own and I'm going to decide what I do. Sheep are completely lost when they're on their own. So, ready or not, there is, though, an urgency to daily living, that water wheel that we talked about, that emptied and filled. That's becoming a ready people, is allowing the emptiness, God filling that emptiness to overflowing so that it moves and we empty again and we go around and around. There's an urgency of being ready, like a pregnant woman. So, Susan, do you have everything, do you have a plan for what's going to happen when those labor pains come? Because you've been through it before, right? Do you?
I'm trying to have a plan.
Okay.
Also, my husband is terrified.
terrified of the pain. And so when you're talking about that transition labor thing.
That's interesting.
So, because last time I was induced and it was a C-section eventually.
Mm-hmm.
So from the little he saw of how I did not handle the pain well, terrified. So where I'm looking at it like, this is something that a woman goes through,
yeah.
And this is just, that's part of what happens.
Mm-hmm.
He's like, you've got to have an epidural.
We got to manage this somehow. That is interesting. Yeah.
There's a lot of fear in managing.
That's interesting. That is interesting. Yeah, no, none at all. Yeah. Interesting. So, first of all, be ready for tribulation. That's where we should be. This is what Jesus is preaching right here. Be ready for tribulation. It will come. It is part of the plan. So, like, it's not like something fell off and, like, oh, what a mess. Now let's put it back on. It's part of the plan. It's in order to get rid of what would be detrimental if it stayed. Susan, would you like to keep that young child in your body for the next 4 or 5 years?
Yeah.
I mean, not a single pregnant woman would go, oh, I just want to keep, let me just keep this forever. Now, there are some portions of it we love, right? We love the feeling of the life in there. But good grief, if we kept, what would happen to us?
Explode.
Yeah, you would explode. That's exactly right.
Yeah.
It would mean your life,
well,
right?
Yeah.
To keep it in.
Would die.
Yeah. Both lives.
Both of them.
So you kind of have this with like the, so like in Mary, right? Jesus came.
Uh-huh.
And so that's like marrying like how God, Jesus comes first through us or in us,
mm-hmm.
for the temple, like
mm-hmm.
giving birth. That,
yep.
And the life around us, right? Okay.
Yep.
And then the second time, it's literally the whole earth is going to
right.
produce the life of us.
Right.
Do you know what I mean?
Yep. Yep.
I don't know.
Yep.
Like, I feel like
there's a lot of this in there. If we begin to explore this metaphor, it becomes really amazing at what's happening even now in the body of Christ, that we're birthing Christ all the time, right? Every time
right.
we overfill with him and we fill grace. But then the whole earth does this.
Mm-hmm.
That it, and even remember the resurrection. I think we'll get to talk about that. What happens when it goes dark and the earth shakes? What else? What comes out?
Yeah,
the all the dead come
yeah.
out of the grave.
Yeah.
It births all this light. Like, wow. There's a lot of birthing that happens. So a pregnant woman knows that there's going to be pain, right? They know that there's going to be pain throughout, from the beginning to the end, and it will get probably a little bit more and more. And they know especially that end pain is coming. But they know that there's going to be an end, right? They know that there actually is going to be an end to all this pain and tribulation. So be ready for it. I mean, I think all pregnant women, but I think, women that are pregnant for the second time know for sure, well, yeah, there's going to be pain. Yeah. And it could be horrific. I mean, and some of us have had easy births and some of us had very difficult births. But pretty much there is pain involved in all of it. Actually, that was kind of a promise, right?
Mm-hmm.
That there would be. So be ready for that, but also be ready for death. Where does a death happen for a pregnant woman? Where does she lose life? Yeah. When the life inside is gone, right? That last push, that baby comes out, you just lost that life inside of you, right? That is a death. And there is, at least for me, I remember, there is a little piece of that, oh, I miss that feeling of having that life inside of me. That I told this the other day, it's a phenomenon. I had probably for 10 years, I had phantom
mm-hmm.
kicks.
Mm-hmm.
Am I the only one who's had that?
No. No, I still.
So every once in a while, you get this feeling of like, and there's this.
Yeah.
I had for a long, long, long time, and I actually loved it. It was just that feeling of.
Mm-hmm.
Oh. So there is a loss of life for a pregnant woman. There is that knowing that this final expulsion is a loss of life to her, and now there's a completely different life and a new life. It's still the same life, kind of, but now it's completely new, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, and the similarities between a womb and a tomb.
Yeah,
you know what
completely.
I mean?
So completely.
Like that cycle.
Exactly. That cycle is exactly what it is. So be prepared for tribulation. Be prepared for death. And so there's lots of deaths that come in your life too. We've talked about this a lot, right? The loss of things in your life. Be prepared. Some of these things have to die or they would explode inside you and they would rip you apart and they would cause more real death rather than little. Yes, of both of us. But then be alert to the new life that actually comes. So when you have tribulation in your life, be also aware that new life is coming. There is the possibility that you can expel that in you, and there will be new life. The new life is the whole goal. This, the joy that makes the tribulation and the death, the expelling, worthwhile, right? So there's celebration. A pregnant woman's pain is always replaced by joy at that expelling.
I think that's in so many stages of life, too. I've had so many people say, oh, aren't you sad your child is leaving for college? No, I'd be sad if they weren't.
Yes, exactly. Yes.
Right. It's
hard because
it is the way our family is.
Right.
That's
right.
An empty seat at the table, and
it'll never go back. Right.
And now, with our daughter getting married, there is a death.
Yep.
But there is a new life.
Yes.
And if we only focus on giving her away,
yes,
then we never realize that we've received.
Yes,
exactly. And we would never have grandchildren, and we would never
have
all of that.
Yep, exactly. And that's really what Jesus is trying to say. This is how life is right now. And there's going to come a point where you're going to experience life, more of my life. If you're not aware of that, if you're always trying to avoid the tribulation and avoid the death, you're never going to see the new life, right? You're never going to do that. I want you to do it all. I want you to be ready for it all. And you're ready for it being a water wheel. You're ready for it always being empty, filled with Him, letting it out, continuing over and over and over again so that this becomes the rhythm of your life and that you get to see the new life that comes. Now, what I want to do is I want you to put down your papers and I want... pray that I can remember how to do the DVD. I want to show you a clip, but I want to actually show it on the big screen because I think it's powerful. I think it shows us, because what we're going into next, the parables, there's three parables that he really talks about that shows you. So how am I ready? What does it look like to be ready? And he gives us three parables about what it looks like to be ready, about what it looks like to live under the breaking of the world, but under the rule of grace. So I could think of nothing better than Les Mis, because it's exactly what it is. So I want to show the clip, and that's what I have on the very bottom is the two clips that we have, the actual dialogue, so you see it. So you're going to have to sit on the floor. There's only a few seats in the living room, but come in the living room and pray that I can remember how to do this so that we can just watch this clip for a minute. Okay, so of course it hasn't worked how it was supposed to. So it may be a little while. Oh, look. Not only do we have three for the TV, but we're a Nielsen family, so we have to always plug in what we're watching. Or tell say what we're watching.
Oh.
Yeah. So I was going to put this on the computer, but it's so hard to, you know, it's all singing, so it's hard to see the voice. The so last night I sat with this all last night.
Is this the new one?
Yes, this is the new one. Yeah. Well, you know what? We watched it the other night, and we said, "Oh, we have to buy this. This is just too good. This may take a few minutes here, because I had to start from the beginning."
What was your book club book?
I chose this as my book club book many years ago, and gave little candlesticks out, silver candlesticks out. I mean, it's the most powerful gospel presentation that you could have. And I think they did such a good job with the musical. And when you read the words, it's really powerful. Maybe. Let's see. Keep on doing this. Oh, yeah. Yeah, can we do that?
No, but my voice, I do it by memory.
So, is there anybody who's not seen Les Mis?
I haven't seen it.
I saw the
musical.
Okay. The musical that they do is very difficult to get the gist. The first time I saw it, I'm like, they lost the focus of what it is. And I think it was Pat, you were reading the unabridged Les Mis, right?
I finished it.
You did. Good for you. Wow. Okay, the unabridged.
Yeah, I'm reading it right
now. Whew.
That's
okay,
the
there we go.
The Pope.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Well, here's the cool thing.
The
come on.
Yeah.
Here we go. The bishop in this one. Come on.
Do you have to point
it
at the DVD player?
There we go.
Yeah.
So the bishop, this guy,
yeah.
This is the original Jean Valjean.
Mm-hmm. Oh.
Yeah. Isn't that cool? Yeah.
From the musical?
From the musical. Okay. So here we go. Oh. So this is Jean Valjean, homeless.
Monsignor, we
have your silver? We caught this man red-handed.
You had the nerve to say you gave him this. That is right. But my friend, you left so early. Surely something slipped your mind. You forgot. I gave these also. Would you leave the best behind? Monsieur, can we see? This man has spoken truth. I commend you for your duty. Now God's blessing go with you. But remember this, my brother. See in this some higher plan. You must use this precious silver to become a lawless man. By the witness of the martyrs, by the passion and the blood, God has raised you out of darkness. I have saved your soul for God. In the night, become a dog on the run. Have I fallen so far, and is the hour so late that nothing remains but the cry of my hate? The cries in the dark that nobody hears. Here where I stand at the turning of the years. If there's another way to go, I missed the 20 long years ago. My life was a war that could never be won. They gave me a number and they murdered Valjean when they chained me and left me for dead. Just a feeling, a mouthful of breath. Why did I allow this man to touch my soul and teach me love? Any other. He gave me his trust. He called me brother. My life he claimed for God above. Can such things be? But I have come to taste the world. This world always hazing me. Take an eye for an eye. Turn your heart into stone. This is all I have lived for. This is all I have. One word from him and I'd be back. Beneath the lash upon the rack. Instead he offers me my freedom. I feel my shame inside me. I can die. He told me that I have a soul. How does he know? What spirit has to know? Is there another way to go? I am reaching for that thought, and the night is closing in. As I stare into the void, to the world on my sin. I'll escape now from that world, for the world of Shambhal-Shan. Shambhal-Shan is nothing now, and then the story must begin.
hope you saw all of the dark, the light, I mean everything. Now I want to show you one more. Okay, I mean everything we've talked about is in there. So this is a man who was given grace and received it. So that was that whole point of he has a new life, the light is shining, he went out from the dark into the light. This next man, Javert, is also given grace by him, by Valjean. He gives him grace, and this is how he deals with it. And when you look at him side by side, the composer did a fantastic job. He wrote them exactly the same, but with different responses. So when you look at that,
when he left the temple too.
Yep. I'm not sure. Let's hope I get to the right one. Okay, so this is the, so that's him coming out.
Almost at the door. Ah.
Sorry, that's a little bit. So he's looking at him, he's given him grace already. He let him go. So he was imprisoned, and Valjean let him go. And now he doesn't know what to do. So this is the parallel song to what you just saw.
This man was so the devil as he to have me caught in a trap and choose to let me go free. It was his hour at last to put a seal on my fate. Wipe out the past and wash me clean off the slate. All it would take was a flick of his knife. Vengeance was his and he gave me back my life. Damned if I live in the dead of a thief. Damned if I yield at the end of a chase. I am the law and the law is not mocked. I'll spit his pity right back in his face. There is nothing on earth but we share. It is either Valjean or Javert. Can my thoughts fly apart? Can this man be believed? Shall his sins be forgiven? Shall his crimes be reprieved? And must I now begin to doubt? Who never doubted all these years. My heart is stone and still it trembles. The world I have known is lost in shadow. Is he from heaven or from hell? And does he know that granted me my life today? This man has killed me, even so. I am reaching the platform, and the stars are black and cold. As I stare into the void of a world that cannot hold, I'll escape now from that world, from the world of Jean Valjean. There is nowhere I can turn, there is nowhere to go.
Pretty amazing after listening to Matthew 24. Mm-hmm. He uses the same words in there. Same amazing thing. Looking. So when Jesus says, how are you ready? You receive grace, you let it fill the emptiness in you, and you let it overflow. This could not receive grace because he had to go according to the law and according to transaction. That's what he talks about Valjean's world. So we can go back and finish it up. We have 10 minutes. But those are the two pictures, and I'm always amazed that I don't know who wrote this. I don't know who wrote the music to this, the lyrics, but they are on target to what Jesus is talking about in Matthew. Mm-hmm. what he's been talking about. And these are the two responses, sheep and the goat. Underneath. So let's come back in. Okay, so what Jesus does then is he gives us three parables at the end of what a readiness life looks like, what a life lived in readiness looks like. And we first start with a wedding again. Virgins, oh, I meant to look this up. Virgins going to a wedding. Here's the cool thing. We actually got to experience an Orthodox Jewish wedding when we were in Israel. And it wasn't... We assume this is women because it says virgins, but it's actually men who lead in men. So I don't know if I meant to look that up or forgot. We watched. It was the most gorgeous thing. I wish I was making the decisions for every wedding. Because these men came from the bottom of the hotel in this spiral staircase, all with candles, singing. All up. And there are all these beautiful Orthodox men in these... this black Orthodox, and it's this beautiful, it's in dark, and it's coming up, and they're coming up with the lights singing. So I have this vision of what this is. So we have this parable then of the virgins, and I believe it's actually men and women, leading in the bridegroom with song and light. Again, it's always with light that the bridegroom comes in, that bridegroom's revealed. We have two separate groups then of people with lights. We have the prudent virgins who know absolutely for sure the groom's coming, but they have no idea when. They don't have any expectations of when, of any certain time. They just know he's coming, and so they're going to be ready whenever it is. And so they carry extra oil with them because they don't have any expectations that he's coming at a certain time. The other group have a picture of exactly when he's coming. Of course he's going to be coming at a reasonable time. He said he's getting married, so of course he's coming in the next 2 or 3 hours. This is just reasonable, right? You wouldn't tell me you're having a wedding and I'm coming, get ready, and you wouldn't come tomorrow, right? That's what they're thinking. That's the whole point of why they don't have oil with them. Because there's an expectation that he's coming according to their picture. So they have a picture of when he's coming, what it's going to look like. And so they feel that they're just as prepared. Because of course he's... In fact, they're probably looking at the other people like, why would you have all that oil? You're going to have to carry a lot of oil around with you because he's coming in a couple hours, if not sooner. So we have expectation versus expectancy. Jesus says... Look, all of them were included in the wedding party. And the funny thing is, later on they're going to find out that they weren't just in the wedding party, they were actually the bride. But they're all included in the wedding party. But some of them chose to put their role of attendant in a box that they made themselves. Well, I'm going to be attendant, it's going to look like this. How many hours? Oh, I'm only required to be there. I mean, have you ever been in a wedding and you're going, oh man, that's my whole day. You know, it's going to end at 9 and I'll be home. That's what they did. You know, I'm going to be an attendant, but so this is going to look like this. I'm going to wear this kind of dress and I'm going to carry this kind of bouquet and we're going to do this and I have this whole picture. Rather than trusting the groom for what's going to happen, they're trusting their picture. It's going to look like this. So we have the difference. They're both included in the group. One decides to make up her own role about what that will look like. So what does it look like to be ready? To live in expectancy, but not in expectation. The second parable we have are the servants given talents. His point here is that we receive blessings as things to bless with rather than what the other one did.
But they didn't.
Hang on. Let's look.
I mean, the bridesmaids didn't.
Oh, the bridesmaids. Okay, but you always have to be careful of parables. He's trying to make one point with that parable. That's why he tells three parables.
Okay.
So he tells one point about living in expectancy, not expectation.
Okay.
So don't look at anything else except the point. Second parable. The point is receive blessings as something to give out. Okay? So don't mix them together. They're not supposed to give all the points. One point each. So we have the servants who multiplied. They have an attitude of stewardship. So the first thing we know is that these stewards saw the giver as good. We know that they saw what the giver gave as a gift. They understood that it was wholly theirs. And therefore, they understood they were accepted already, that the gift had nothing to do with their acceptance, but that the gift was given as a gift. It was theirs to do with. Therefore, they could risk, they could release the gift and do with it whatever they liked. They could release it because they knew that their acceptance wasn't tied to the gift. Does this make sense? They didn't receive that gift and go, oh, this is all about whether I'm going to do good enough or not to be accepted. What they knew is, I'm accepted. And this is a gift. And I can release it because it has nothing to do with whether I'm accepted or not. How do we know that? Because of the opposite. He's showing opposites here. We have the other servant who takes it. And first of all, how does he see the giver?
As a hard man.
Yeah, as a hard man. Not a good man, a hard man. He sees the giver as a hard man. He sees what is given not as a gift, but as an obligation. Here's an obligation, and because it's an obligation, it's not his own. He doesn't see it as being given to him for himself. It's not his. It's something that he now has to protect in order to avoid punishment. I got to protect this. It's not mine. I got to protect it because this is the test here. It's a test, and if I pass the test, I'm accepted. You see the difference of even of the attitude? I know I'm accepted, so the gifts I get, I can joyously use rather than, oh, I'm given this to see if I'm going to be accepted. So this is the difference between inclusion first versus exclusion first. This is how he sees it. He doesn't see it that it was meant. The first servant sees it, it's a privilege and a joy to be able to rejoice in it. The second, it's not meant for joy. It's just duty. This is what we saw in Javert. We see this man throughout the whole thing. Duty. Life is a duty. Life is an obligation. I got to do it, and then I'll be accepted. And that's why he's so conflicted at the end. I didn't show a piece where he's conflicted because of the little boy who dies. And I mean, Russell Crowe does a fantastic job with his eyes, because his eyes stay at all. Like, I don't know what to do with this. I don't know what to do in a world that I've done everything I'm supposed to do, and I'm not getting what I... It doesn't make sense to me. Life is a duty. And I think he says something very similar to that. This is what the two servants look like. Very different. Both, though, and you have to notice this, both are called the master's own. They both belong to him. They both are a piece of his household. But the one servant decides he wants to be an outsider. He doesn't want to receive a gift. He doesn't want to receive his acceptance. He wants to be able to trade it for what he does with it. And when that happens, you don't end up with anything. When you are able to release what you're given, because I already know I'm accepted. So let's talk about the very beginning in that movie where I showed you the priest, the bishop. He's got silver, all of this. And it doesn't even faze him. that Jean Valjean has taken it, and he's going to say, yeah, it's his. It's his. He knows that it's just there to give. And he gives it, and in giving it, what we see throughout the whole movie is what Jean Valjean does with the grace. In fact, if you read the book, you get it even much deeper. I mean, it's amazing. He turns the whole town around. Now, here's the most amazing thing about Les Mis. I've never heard it anywhere, but I've read it. That was actually a real man. Did you know that? Mm-hmm. He wrote that. Victor Hugo wrote that about a man he knew who actually had very similar things happen to him. And he was strong. He actually did the cart thing. And he turned a whole town around because he lived a life of grace. Mm-hmm. So it's not just a movie. This really happens. And Jesus says, this really happens. You receive the gift. You're completely empty. You receive it and it overflows. It creates more and more and more and more and more. If you don't, it just kills it all and crushes it to pieces. The last piece, which was part of our memory verses, was seeing the least. So what does it mean to be ready? It means to live in expectancy rather than expectation. Receive blessings in order to bless. But in receiving those blessings, you have to have the emptiness to receive them, to know that it's grace that you're getting them, to be able to let them be filling you and overflowing you. And seeing the least at meeting the littleness, the truth that Jesus is in those who are least and little, who are, and here's what the story of Les Mis does. And I mean, even the title, what does the title mean?
The miserable ones,
the little ones, the least ones. That's what that title means. And Valjean sees that in everybody, including the man who has hunted him down every single day of his life. He sees even in him, and he gives him his life. He releases him from being killed by the uprising. The truth is that Jesus is behind all of those little ones and least ones. And he says, the sheep, the ones who receive my grace, actually see hunger and thirst and nakedness and imprisonment. They see it in others because they know it's been in them. They know it's in them. They recognize it. And they know that they had no way of filling it, but that they got it filled. They had grace shown to them. And they are able then to meet the need then of someone else. Those who didn't, those goats were independent. So when they see hunger, they think, well, when I was hungry, I fed myself. So I'm looking for someone. What they are doing is they want to feed Jesus, supposedly. They're looking for a worthy Jesus, though. Mm-hmm. And Jesus says, no, I'm actually in the unworthy ones. I'm actually in the little ones. I'm in Javert. I'm in the worst that you can think of. I'm in the people who put those bombs in there. And see, that just does something to our whole sense of like, can we do that? This is the good news of the gospel, because it is all of us. We're all, like Sherilyn said, we're all terrorists. We do this all the time. We're all Javerts, even, right? And yet, do we want to reject what he's given us? When we reject it in others, and we say, you know, I fed myself. I pulled myself up by my bootstraps. You know, I did that. Because that's what we say, right, when we judge other people. I mean, that's what I told you last week. You know, I share some of these stupid, embarrassing things to say. I used to say to people, how dare you say you don't have time for Bible study? I homeschooled and I'm studying and I'm teaching. I mean, that was Javert standing right up there with these medals all over me. I've done it all, so should you. That's what a goat does. And Jesus says, no, actually, you haven't done it all. And you haven't even seen your leastness in that. That's where I'm at. That's the leastness. This is the culmination of what he's been teaching them about what the kingdom looks like. It is a place of healing and restoration for those who are little and least and empty And that's where the kingdom resides. I have then the words of the two songs. You can look at them later. But notice, please, the parallels that the writer did about each of these. I mean, I could go through it all, and just every time I look at it, I think, oh, man, he was so good. Even the way, now I took this right off of how they wrote it. Even the way they wrote it, notice at the very end, the last sentence is off to the left. It's like, here's the climax of what comes. Valjean, the one who receives grace, says, another story must begin. There's new life. Javert says, there is no way to go on. That's the conclusion. I can't go on living this. He would not receive, and he's thrown out. I mean, literally, he gets thrown out into the river there. So, boy, there's a lot more I could say about that, but I do think that more than anything, when it comes to Jesus talking about tribulation and death, this is meant to be. There is a new life coming in him, and it is in receiving the filling with grace of our emptiness. Father, thank you that you in so many ways teach us the gospel, fill us with grace. Father, I pray that in these days that it does seem like perhaps there are wars and rumors of wars and famines and earthquakes and bombings and all sorts of hatred to one another, that we might endure by living in grace, by being people who are empty and filled and empty and filled, that we might take that opportunity to let people see Jesus revealed, to see the kingdom revealed, to see that he wants little ones. We thank you that you are the God of grace. In Jesus' name, amen.